Guys, how's the form? Thanks so much for joining us. Episode 5 here of The Ditch in collaboration with Red Wolf. I'm Owen McNeil, joined by everyone's two favourite senior hurlers, Paulie Doyle on my left, Roman Shorthall on my right, the Adrian Fenlon and Larry O'Gormans of the game. Got a lot to chat about this afternoon. We're going to be talking about Athlone and what's going on with the guards in Athlone. Funny goings on in Athlone. Do we need to shut down Athlone till we can figure out what's going on there? We're also going to be talking about the guards more generally and their history, whom they represent, what kind of peace they're really defending. We're also then going to talk about, well, whatever you want to call it, the ascension, the coronation, or some would say the election of Simon Harris as Taoiseach. We're going to be talking about whether we should have a general election or whether you respect Bunreacht na hÉireann, as we all should, I suppose. We're going to be talking to Leo Varadkar later on. He's going to be joining us to talk about his tenure as Taoiseach and his future plans. Where's he going to go? Stay with us and we'll have a little chat about that. Before Christmas, Roman, we published a print edition titled State Failures. Your essay in that was titled History of Violence, An Garda Síochána. And that was one of those, when you first mentioned it, that you wanted to write an essay called A History of Violence. I was like, yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much. With a wee tip of the hat to Ed Harris and Viggo Mortensen. What do you mean when you say An Garda Síochána, A History of Violence?
We just forgot to mention, actually, that this episode is sponsored by the Association of Garda Sergeants and Inspectors.
My apologies to Antoinette Cunningham.
Antoinette Cunningham, yeah.
She's just announced her retirement, actually, as well. You couldn't find a better defender of the indefensible?
No. I wouldn't be surprised, like, if she gets into politics now or something like that. Run for Fine Gael, maybe.
Before we get into the guard specifically, she got into it with Ming Flanagan this week, didn't she? Or was it last week?
Yeah, I think he tweeted something along the lines of An Garda Síochána is rotten to the core, I think. And
he was also, you know, he followed that up to make clear that he was talking about the institution. I mean, you can get into it, different theories about individual guards or not, but Ming Flanagan, in his own words, he was talking about the institution rather than individual guardy.
Yeah, and I don't think he even needed to clarify that, because he said An Garda Síochána, he didn't say guardy, so, you know, it was quite obvious he was talking about the organisation. And Agsi, and I think Antoinette Cunningham as well were very upset about it. And we got the usual spiel of, you know, all our brave, great Gardaí, and this is so insulting to them, and, you know. But, like, if you look at Agsi's tweets and stuff like that, you know, if you search for Maurice McCabe or things like that, you won't find any sort of outrage or...
Well, look, I mean, obviously, Ming Flanagan is obviously a bastard. You're obviously a bastard as well, because you wrote an essay titled History of Violence. What do you mean by that? What do you account for your actions?
I mean, all Gardaí are bad.
Yeah.
Obviously. I mean, like, history of violence, like, the organisation itself does have a history of violence. Violence predominantly, you know, against people in working class areas. That's how they have historically policed in working class areas. And, you know, we've seen at many kind of big protests over the years, you know, such as the May Day protests in
RoboCop,
yeah, who's now an ethics expert for An Garda Síochána, naturally. You know, we saw how they behaved at the Shell to Sea protests. We've seen, you know, more recently how they behaved, at Debenhams. So Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fair thing to say that the organisation does have a history of violence, as I'm sure do a lot of other police organisations, you know.
Polly, are you similarly a bastard? I mean, like, who do you think the guards, in whose interests do they work?
Well, they're there. The purpose of the police is to, under capitalism, is to uphold the distribution of wealth and power. That's, the guards are no different. All of the protests that they misbehaved at, you'll notice, were left-wing organised ones, right? And the reason, the fact that their purpose is to protect the distribution of wealth and power informs who they target and the level of force that they use. They're very, very heavy-handed in all the instances that you mentioned. Yet when it comes to, say, fascists attacking people in Sandwich Street, or cracking down on people who are going around burning asylum centres, or even just trying to, like, obstruct and stop openly fascist, seditious groups from organising, they seem to forget that they're able to, that they have powers, right? But if you look at, say, the logic of policing under the current kind of socioeconomic system we have, it kind of makes perfect sense, because why would they target these people? Because they're actually not a threat to the distribution of wealth and power, if that makes sense.
Why don't we talk about this when we consider policing? Why doesn't Paul Reynolds speak in these terms, for example? RTE crime correspondent.
Well, when it comes to how the, you know, people like Paul Reynolds, I don't want to single anyone out, but crime reporting...
Oh, no, I think you've just done that.
Crime reporting generally, and it's something that you touch on in the essay, is there's a kind of an implicit understanding between crime reporters and guards, where senior officials in the police will give them access to confidential information in exchange for them kind of, you know, putting forward narratives that favour on Garda Síochána. So you'll notice that more often than not, any sort of a failure on the part of an Garda Síochána, it's usually spun as kind of a lack of resources, right? Or a lack of support from politicians to the police. And if there is someone blamed, it's because people who are high up on the guards have basically hung them out to dry, right? You'll also notice, and we've talked about this a little bit before, that the net has been closing in on the Kinahan cartel for close to 7 or 8 years now, right? The media are, you know, perfectly happy to facilitate the guards making this claim at a press conference, you know, almost on a weekly or monthly basis for close to a decade now, because that's the relationship they have with
him. How is Daniel Kinahan doing in his Dubai bolt hole?
He's quivering in his Dubai bolt hole at the moment, as Drew Harris has once again vowed to make sure that the net closes in on him. You know, it's like, I don't know. It really does seem every time the Department of Justice or the guards are in hot water, they hold a press conference, tabloid hacks come along, they ask the same questions, and we get headlines that, you know, look at all this progress that we've made. But I mean, there was a really interesting piece out a couple of weeks ago by John Mooney, right?
Oh, yeah.
And he talked about how Christy Kinahan, while Drew Harris, Helen McEntee, and all of these people were talking about how any day now he's going to end up in an American prison, was globetrotting, leaving reviews of luxury hotels.
What
and
kind of
restaurants
reviews was he leaving? Is he a Harris reviewer?
He came across as someone who is very busy and in a rush, and kind of, if he's left waiting,
he was still leaving reviews. Is he a man of taste?
he's a fellow man of culture, you know. So I mean, that's the extent to which those sanctions have had. The net is closing in on them, and you know, no one seems to have. There's this culture in the media, and I suppose maybe more generally in Irish society, of just taking what the guards say at face value.
So the guards would never lie.
No, they
lied to John McGurk.
It's just the John McGurk defense. Like, the police officer lied to me.
Just a few bad apples. I just want to go back to the Christy Kinahan thing, because I think that would make for a really good reality TV show, where he just goes around and inspects hotels.
Kind of like,
what's that show on RTE called?
The restaurant, like, or, you know, he could play like a Tom Dooley role.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, just like restaurants, hotels, stuff like that. He could just go and review them. Like,
Paulie was talking about the media there and the deference shown to guards. Also, I suppose the general public is all going like, oh, fuck, guard wouldn't lie. Something you wrote about in your essay was Heather Humphreys, friend of the ditch, told us to fuck off and leave her alone. Well, she was justice minister.
She was right, to be fair.
Well, yeah, we are assholes. Heather Humphreys, when she was justice minister, she took questions in the Dáil about the cause of Terence Wheelock's family.
Yeah.
As you mentioned in your piece, a number of politicians have taken up the plight of the Wheelock family, namely Breed Smith, Gary Gannon, Paul Murphy, Lynn Ruan and the Shannad. I think in this instance, Paul Murphy was seeking for the case of Terence Wheelock, who was a teenager from inner city Dublin who was taken into Garda custody and died of, I mean, the most neutral way of putting it is, well, he died of injuries sustained while in Garda custody. Paul Murphy was seeking for this case to be reopened, seeking to have a number of outstanding questions answered. Tell us how Heather Humphreys responded to Paul Murphy.
Well, she didn't tell him to fuck off.
No. Well, that would be unparliamentary language, I suppose. Yeah.
She responded by using it. Basically, like, as I would say a lot of people know at this stage, the cell in which Terence Wheelock sustained his injuries was very swiftly decorated and cleaned up and tidied up, refurbished soon after the incident. And
tell us what that incident was like. The
well, if we are to believe the Garda narrative, I think there's an awful lot of evidence to suggest that we shouldn't believe it, that Terence hung himself with a cord from his tracksuit bottoms and later died in hospital. And yes, the cell where this happened, or supposedly happened, where he supposedly hung himself, was refurbished. And Paul Murphy asks about reopening Terence's case, and Heather Humphreys uses it as an opportunity to basically say how great it is that, like, all these cells have been refurbished, all these Garda cells. Like, it's a kind of a bizarre interaction. She also said that she couldn't intervene in the Wheelock case.
She has intervened in other cases.
She has intervened in other cases. If you are a friend of hers who happens to be a farmer that likes to hurt animals, then yes, she will intervene on your behalf, as she did before, and arguably should have resigned over, but didn't, because that's fine, you know. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like, that's where it's at the moment. That's the government's firm position, is that they're not going to look into it. And I mean, there's so much evidence to suggest that something untoward happened in that cell. You know, there was records changed by guards. You know, it must have been the few bad apples that the media talks about. But yeah, I mean, it's just a stone wall, like, for so long now. And despite, you know, all of this evidence, nobody wants to revisit what happened, you know.
And why do you think that is? Why does Heather Humphreys intervene in the case of a farmer who abuses animals but won't intervene in the case of the Wheelock family?
Well, there's several reasons. One reason is because they're working class, right? And I think it's quite clear that the state values the lives of working class people far less than, say, middle class or upper class people. You know, you touched on this a bit in the essay as well, Roman. I mean, the fact that the Wheelock family are working class is related, you know, definitely contributed to the treatment that they received from the guards afterwards. You know, they were harassed and threatened and intimidated while they were in their own home for trying to draw attention, you know, to this case. You know, the other thing is that it's politically, I guess, you'd be, if you open a box and you start looking into this case, well, then that's precedent, and you have to start looking into all of the other questionable instances, you know, involving disproportionate use of Garda force. So I would imagine that she just doesn't want to go near it because of, you know, the potential consequences of looking into this one case, because there's so many other ones. It's not just Terence Wheelock.
There's loads. I mean, I think it was Paul Murphy a couple of years ago put in I think it was a parliamentary question to Helen McEntee, and like got back like some fairly kind of shocking statistics of how many people have died in just, I think, in the past maybe 10, 20 years, something like that, in Garda cells or having interacted with the guards and have died. And I've gone through a couple of them myself. We wrote about one of them in Waterford. Like, just bizarre fucking circumstances where, you know, people are apparently like feeding their belt out of the cell and hooking it on the outside and all, like very, very strange circumstances. And again, like in that case as well, like as Paulie just said, you know, we're talking about young working class men. I mean, I do think that, you know, it would take maybe like someone from Fox Rock to die in a Garda cell in suspicious circumstances for any of this to kind of be looked at. Because, you know, invariably it is working class men that die in these cells. So, I mean, that's why there just isn't the kind of pressure there to actually, you know, revisit these suspicious deaths.
You mentioned Waterford there, and we have covered some goings on in Dungarvan and County Waterford and policing in the county. It's something that we want to cover more in the future, actually, as well.
We've only touched the fucking surface of it.
Another place, Athlone. We named two Gardaí, Garda George Garvin and Garda Tom Higgins. Why did we name them this week?
Because allegedly they were involved in drug dealing in Athlone.
And how do we know that?
From the guards, from a Garda intelligence report. So like we have this Garda intelligence report from 2014, which sets out some extremely serious allegations. It's from the Garda National Intelligence Unit, which is the unit within a Garda Síochána that collates intelligence. And that's what they did. And they collated this intelligence about guards in Athlone, three guards. The third, who unfortunately we're not in a position to name yet. The first guard is Garda George Garvey, who, according to this document, is alleged to have planted drugs or orchestrated the planting of drugs on an individual, in an individual's car, heroin, I believe, and subsequently, based on the allegations that the drugs were planted, the DPP didn't actually prosecute the person who allegedly had these drugs in their car. And that's not all, you know, but wait, there's more, as they say in the TV ads. George Garvey was the subject of even more serious allegations in 2010, which we know from another document, where a sergeant in Athlone wrote to the station superintendent and said, George Garvey is in a relationship with a suspected heroin dealer and is allegedly tipping off drug dealers before they're raided. Like, very extremely serious stuff. And
they don't teach that in Templemore.
No, it was upheld as well at a much later date, six years later, according to a report.
Yeah, there was an internal report that found that there was substance to a lot of these allegations. And there was a internal disciplinary report that I think was, having read all of the documents relating to it, I think it was killed in very strange circumstances. So that's George Garvey. Then you've got Tom Higgins, who was allegedly buying drugs from a person who was described in the report as the biggest drug dealer, or one of the biggest drug dealers in Athlone, ran up a debt with that drug dealer, wouldn't pay the debt, and basically the reason that he said he wouldn't pay the debt is because he had looked after that drug dealer. So that's Tom Higgins. And then you have a third guard who apparently was trying to sell, according to this report, cocaine. The report said that he was trying to sell cocaine for 7,000 euro, but that it was worth a lot more. And also that he was in a relationship with a teenage girl and allegedly bet the shit out of her at a hotel. This is on Garda Síochána in Athlone.
Boys in blue who put green before the badge. I always think that there's a bit of like Irish exceptionalism to this kind of stuff, where, you know, cops like these, look, it's a trope elsewhere in the world. It's a trope in different forms of media, whether they be books, TV shows, films. There are other documented instances of this kind of behavior in police forces across the world. We've never really had stories like these in Ireland. And I think Irish people are reluctant to believe that of An Garda Síochána. Why do you think that is, Paulie?
Because because there's a history of
violence.
I think it touches. It goes back to what a person from the Association of Garda Sergeants and Inspectors tried to do, which was there's a conflation of people talking about institutional corruption and how that manifests in the actions of various Garda, various officers. You know, there's a conflation pointing that out with, say, criticizing all guards. People have on their mind, oh, well, my uncle is a guard, or my cousin is a guard, and sure, he's sound. And, you know, people don't seem to be able to kind of separate those two, you know. I also think the state is kind of frightened of going after the guards because of what it would imply, you know. I mean, what would it actually mean politically if you were to try and meaningfully reform the guards? You'd have to completely dismantle it.
Can I ask you, actually, it's something I talk about a fair bit, something I think about often. The Jobstown trial and was it 80 Garda statements that were found to be false?
It was a lot of bad apples.
But this is what I kind of, and look, Gene Carrigan has written about this as well in the Sunday Independent before his retirement. You have anti-water charges protesters on trial, people before Prophet TD, Paul Murphy among them, other locals from the Jobstown area. I remember speaking to people about this at the time, Irish liberals who would absolutely balk at the suggestion that there was some level of political policing involved, separation of powers, rule of law. I learned this in CSPE, you know.
Bunroch na hÉireann.
Yeah, Bunroch na hÉireann. I remember at the time, this was 2015, 16, wasn't it? There was a complete reluctance or unwillingness to even tinker with the idea that there might be some level of politics involved with. I mean, firstly, how that protest was policed, secondly, how it was covered in the media, and then thirdly, how it was investigated, and then fourthly, how it was prosecuted.
How guards perjured themselves in court, and it was all of their testimonies were disproven by video evidence.
This is what I'm going to get. You know, like, do you think that the state and the people who comprise it have reckoned with what actually happened in the courtroom that day, as far as it was 80 statements, wasn't it, from members of An Garda Síochána?
The judge
instructed the jury, basically said, don't be listening to those guards. They're lying.
They're lying.
The guards are lying to you. And like, there are 80 of them. So like, I mean, like, how do you even consider this? Do you go like, wow, fuck, we've got 80 individual guards who are individual liars and all happen to come up with the same lie? That's pretty bad. It's pretty implausible as well.
I think it's a disgrace that you've just said that.
Every day are brave. No, but
like the state is still, I'm still reeling from the fact that it lost that case. I mean, Paul Murphy was found not guilty.
Face it, not guilty.
By a jury of his peers, right? It went to trial. This is what we're supposed to do in a civilized democracy, right? You go to trial, your peers evaluate the case, they decide whether you're guilty or not. He's found not guilty. That's supposedly the end of it. But he's still, anytime he goes on TV, for example, and he tries to criticize the far right, what's the first thing that's brought up?
Well, you
fucking kidnapped Joan Burton, right? Right. Leo Varadkar in The Dáil, right?
Well,
has invoked this before. It's like, just because you were found innocent by a jury of your peers doesn't mean it was the right thing to say. And it's just kind of like, are you not? I mean, that is surely undermining the court system.
Which is it? Like, I mean, it's always...
Do we have the rule of law or not?
Yeah, this is always, like, it's always rolled out, like, you know, the Constitution and the rule of law, but, like, it's usually only rolled out, like, to protect people in the centre or on the right. Do you know what I mean? It's never, you know, when it comes to people on the left, it's kind of like, oh, well, like, fuck you. Do you know what I mean? Maybe you weren't really guilty.
I think that you've seen, particularly in the US, where oftentimes members of the political establishment can be a little bit more candid there, where I think, was it Gerald Ford spoke about the pardoning of Nixon, where he basically said that, like, look, had to do it, had to pardon this guy, you know, forget about the rule of law, that the stability of our nation required it. Like, so this idea that everyone is treated equally under the law, it's always aspirational. You'll have members of the, particularly the Fine Gael establishment, they're the party of law and order. They're the party of the rule of law, you know? I mean, what do you think those 80 untrue Gardaí statements to the Jobstown trial, what do you think it actually meant? Like, how did that happen?
Well, I mean, usually how these things happen is that there's an instruction from higher above, do you know what I mean, within the organization, that this is what's happening and this is what you're going to do. Because, you know, it's not really kind of plausible, I think, that just, you know, 80 or whatever the number was, guards just decided each individually without kind of prodding or instruction that they were just going to lie about what they saw. Do you know what I mean?
They came up with the same lie.
Yeah, they just came up with the same lie. Like, it's clear that it was coordinated. Do you know what I mean? There isn't really much more of an explanation for it other than someone coordinated that and told them, this is what you're going to say in your statement. Do you know what I mean? And I think, like, that's where you kind of really get into the kind of meat of the institutional corruption or institutional kind of bad behavior in An Garda Síochána. It's from the higher ranks down. Like, that's how it works. It isn't just like all these young guards go in and, like, you know, straight away start doing dodgy stuff. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
It's a culture. And we've seen recently as well, like, I know I don't like saying this, like, but to be fair to Drew, you know, he, like, there has been a bit of a crackdown, like, on, like, we've seen guards now, there's not, we can't say kind of too much about it because they've to face trial, but, you know, there's three or four guards recently charged over an incident in Dublin involving, like, going into a house somewhere, I think in Harold's Cross, somewhere like that. There's been a guard convicted of selling immigration stamps, like, because, you know, the guards are responsible for the GNIB, the Immigration Bureau. We've seen guards convicted of assault, recently coercive control. There's another guard I saw there in the papers on Sunday is going to go on trial over some sort of insurance scam that she allegedly was involved with. So, I mean, clearly there are a lot of guards involved in some very dodgy things. Do you know what I mean? And like AGSI and, you know, the Garda Representative Association, I'm sure they're the same, like, would just like us to, like, ignore the fact that there's a fuckload of guards involved in, like, some seriously dodgy things. I'm like, you know, if that's the attitude that people are expected to take and that, you know, politicians are going to take, then, you know, it's just that culture is going to continue. It's never going to be addressed.
There was some serious resistance to them trying to bring in random drug testing as well for members of An Garda Síochána Síochána as well. Like, there was a report recently enough that it was due to be implemented soon, but they've been talking about this for years and years and years, just a very basic measure in which the Garda Anti-Corruption Unit would randomly select guards to be tested for things like cocaine, heroin, cannabis. In other words,
I hear there was a lot of pushback, Polly, in Athlone, I believe.
For the police to have to obey the laws that they go around enforcing, right?
Yeah.
Huge resistance over that. You also had a vote of no confidence in Drew Harris, because he tried to reform the rostering system, right? So, like, in fairness, if you were trying to actively enact some sort of reform, you've got your work cut out for you.
Just, and something that you touched on a little while ago, something that Roman has said about the Jobstown trial and that there was, there was a conspiracy, right? Some people do act in conspiracy.
Yeah.
We're saying that these, that Gardaí conspired to lie in their statements.
Probably, yeah.
And Roman suggesting that, well, how do conspiracies like that come around? Whether some kind of order or suggestion or something in that vein, right? Now, personally, I'm ambivalent about the role of policing when it comes to protest. I'm also, you know, I'm reluctant to call for policing of protests as far as freedom of expression goes, you know.
Yeah.
I'm just ambivalent about the, you know, even if it's a political protest that you don't like, apart from anything, I'm ambivalent at best about the efficacy of policing when it comes to policing these kind of protests. All that said, and just on what we know, Why do Gardaí not conspire and do what they did in Jobstown than when it comes to whatever you want to call it, you know, right wing, further right, far right, fash, conservative, tradcalf, whatever you want to call these protests? Why is there a different approach there?
It's an interesting question. I mean, on the one hand, yeah, it's a matter of official policy from Drew Harris and Helen McEntee that we need to treat these guys with a light touch, right? That's for reasons we discussed earlier. I think, which is that if your job is to enforce property rights and uphold the distribution of power, then this group, nasty though they may be, aren't actually a threat to that. So there's no need to really use your resources to go after them because they're not threatening the thing that you're protecting, right? Another aspect of this, actually, I think, is that some guards probably identify with these guys because the fascist power fantasy, right? The idea that you are going to go around with your friends in a uniform and use justified violence to cleanse society of undesirable people is very similar to the power fantasies that inform some of the people who join on Garda Síochána Síochána. So there's an affinity there between these groups.
Some of those who work forces?
Yeah.
I'm going to tell Antoinette what you said.
Is that not true, though? I think that there's, you know...
Kind of, I'm a little bit shocked at how little respect both of you have for the rule of law and in separation of powers and our parliamentary democracy. On that, we're going to move on to, as we said at the start, Simon Harris, new Taoiseach down south. Was he coronated? Did he ascend to power? Was he elected? A lot of kind of chatter about how Fine Gael didn't have a leadership election. Personally, actually, I'm just kind of like, who cares? just let them. I don't actually care about that at all. You know, would it be better for Irish democracy if Simon Harris faced off against whoever was willing to go up against him in Fine Gael? Nah.
They're not a normal party for doing this.
Not a normal party. What was your favorite piece of coverage of his election as Taoiseach?
Simon Harris's parents show us his baby photos.
What the fuck was that?
They go, here's Simon making his confirmation, and it's a photo of him from fucking last year.
There was a lot of that kind of coverage where I was like, yeah, like pictures of his photo albums, and there was the picture of him, Seán Maloney, the Irish Independent, had a picture of him ordering his breakfast in Leinster House, and it said something like, a very humble Simon Harris.
Down to earth, I think.
It's like, what is that? Are people like reading this going, oh, he just like me for real, he eats breakfast?
The Irish Independent, another favourite of mine, it's not directly related to Harris, but like there was a piece in the Irish Independent that was talking about Coveney, and it was like, the prince who was never to be king.
Oh, yeah.
This is a personal favourite of mine.
But the question is then, so you have this election as Taoiseach.
air quotes election.
Yeah, well, he was elected by the Dáil, as you know. And this is, you know, Richard Boyd Barrett. He was on one in the Dáil. He was saying it was a disgrace that, you know, the Dáil had cleared its business. It was all just about getting people like Eamon Ryan's speech, where he got up and he congratulated Dara O'Brien on his record in housing. I think he congratulated Stephen Donnelly on his record in health. Unedifying, you know, for a Green Party leader to be up doing that. But that was the general timbre of the day. You have Simon Harris's family watching from the gallery, and Richard Boyd Barrett, he got on one about this, and he gets up. He said it was disgraceful that we'd have a jamboree. Sean O'Farrell, he picks up the mic and he's like, sorry, should not call this a jamboree. You should respect our constitution, Bunrock na hÉireann, because it was the constitution that provided for Simon Harris to be elected. You know that guy Frank Coughlin, the Irish Independent.
Yeah, that's your friend, isn't it?
I love that guy. Yeah, I love that guy. He's extremely sensible, Frank Coughlin. And
he's in competition for the most sensible man in Ireland. Oh, 100%. Him and Pat are like.
Yeah. I'm like a lot of people outside Frank Coughlin's immediate family, that I wake up every week he publishes his piece in the Irish Independent. I go, class, can't wait to see what Frank Coughlin.
New Frank Coughlin drops.
Yeah. And it's always just like, his pieces are always the same. It's always just like, I can't believe, like in this instance, like, you know, I can't believe people are angry about something. Have they not read Bunrock na hÉireann? And do they not respect the fact that we live in a parliamentary democracy? Do you think we should have a general election, or do you respect our constitution?
I respect our constitution.
You respect our
constitution? No, I mean, like, morally, you know. I mean, no, it's actually worth pointing out as well. that the reason this government was formed after an election was because a current coalition partner put forward a motion of no confidence in the guy who's now currently the fucking Taoiseach, and they're congratulating and having, let's not call it a jamboree, to celebrate it, right? Look, I think we've had how many years of Fine Gael now? Is it 13, 14, whatever it is, too many, right? There are, I mean, look at some of the issues that we're facing internationally that they've shown that they're just incapable of dealing with, say like climate change, right? Scientific consensus is overwhelming, right? We're facing potential civilizational collapse by 2100 unless we take meaningful action. We need to radically transform the economy and get away from fossil fuels, right? We have a Green Party in. One of the first things that they did, right, was to say, okay, yeah, well, we're going to commit to 7% reduction in emissions on average by 2030, right? Kicking the can down the road in terms of meeting our, you know, targets for reducing emissions, right? There's been no meaningful action to try and, you know, move away from fossil fuels, to try and create a green economy, right? We continue to do things like, I don't know, open data centers, right?
Do you not use Twitter on your phone? That's the fucking other guy thing.
That's ironic
that you're tweeting about data centers.
But that's an abject failure that should disqualify them immediately. The other thing is, say, the threat of nuclear war at the moment. If you take, like, say, what's happening in Ukraine, this kind of like vortex.
Nuclear war is good now, I thought. Have I missed something? I thought we should be hurtling towards nuclear
war. What I'm saying is, like, you know, you've got like weapons manufacturers, military industrial complex pouring weapons into that country for a huge profit. Weapons are ending up in the hands of God knows who, increasing the chances of the conflict escalating. All the while, you've got the European Union actively militarizing its economy, right, to try and bolster growth. What have we done as a neutral country, supposedly neutral country? We fucking cheered it on. We have this perverse situation in which Ireland, which has a proud history of neutrality and was the first ever country to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty, now cheering on a war that is increasing the risk of us facing a nuclear apocalypse, right? That's on an international scale. Back home, you're dealing with three political parties that have a fanatical commitment to the financialization of housing. They will not do anything that will bring house prices or rents down. They just won't do it. Doesn't matter how many human interest pieces there are about homelessness. Doesn't matter how many children don't have somewhere to live. Doesn't matter how many people who are fucking knocking 40's door down are stuck in their parents' box room. They won't do it because it's an ideological commitment. They're incapable of dealing with the challenges facing this country, both in an international context and at home. So actually, you know, in the name of, I'm going to use a buzzword, decency, we should be calling a general election to try and get them out.
So you don't respect the Constitution?
Okay. I think that's very clear.
It's clear that this guy, real bastard, doesn't respect the institution of An Garda Síochána, doesn't respect our fucking constitution, Paulie. Our fucking constitution.
Sorry.
What is democracy to you? Like, this is, like, and I ask this because, you know,
God.
I mean, like, you know, Alain Badiou, like, would talk about how when people talk about democracy, it always just ends up, you know, the Frank Cochrane's of the world, it always just means parliamentary liberalism, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, even if you look at the coverage of Simon Harris's coronation yesterday, like, it was, I don't know, I found some of it like kind of bizarre, like, where, you know, we would be getting like sort of stuff like where, well, it's not, he's not officially Taoiseach yet, and, you know, he's going to drive to Áras an Uachtaráin, and it's all like, you know, a lot of people who talk, you know, incessantly about democracy and stuff, they're, you know, it's, as you said, it's the procedure and the pomp, and do you know what I mean? Like, it's
pomp.
Yeah. There's no kind of like, there's nothing really behind it.
Mainstream academia, political science, like a lot of mainstream academia, political science, you know, it shifts further and further right. It's deference to established power structures, it increases, but even even with that, there's, you know, there's reasonable debate within academic circles about what democracy is, you know, the will of the people. How do you enact that will? And which is why,
like, am I having a general election?
Yeah, but see, this is, you know, like, this is why when people talk about this kind of stuff, it's always that fucking Churchill quote. People always go like, oh, well, democracy is not the best form of government, but it's better than all the rest. You know, it's these trite maxims. You know, people also say, like, what is democracy? Oh, it's when the ruling party can lose an election. You know, this kind of stuff. Ah, yes, very good. Yes, I'll remember. I'll go vote again.
Politics, yeah, is the art of the possible.
Politics is the art of the possible.
But like, there's never any kind of, you know, this talk, like, about, you know, oh, well, you know, people were saying Fine Gael, opposition politicians were saying Fine Gael shouldn't get to choose the next Taoiseach. And, you know, there was this, the usual crap, like, where people were saying, oh, well, like, that's not true. It's Bunrock na HÉireann.
Have they not read Bunrock na HÉireann?
Yeah. And, like, it's such fucking bullshit. Of course people fucking know, like, that TDs vote for the Taoiseach. But, like, the government has a majority, so, you know, they have this deal in place. Whoever the fucking is the Fine Gael leader is going to be Taoiseach. That's... So, you know, it may not be, like, procedurally correct to say that, you know, and they know this, like, that, you know, the next leader isn't chosen by Fine Gael, or the next Taoiseach isn't chosen by Fine Gael, but, like, that's the fucking reality. Do you know what I mean? And there's never any kind of, like, you know, discussion, like, about, you know, okay, you have, like, the legal reality or constitutional reality, but what about, like, the actual reality? Like, does this government still have a mandate? Do you know what I mean? Like, legally, yes, like, they do, but, you know, morally, do they have a mandate? Like, they took a fucking hammering in the referenda. Like, you know, at what point does a government lose its... you know, kind of moral...
it's moral authority. And yeah, it's that thing, like, to go back to Badia, like, where he talks about how, for these people, the question of the good state, it stops becoming, right, what does a good state actually look like? And it's more just about, let's follow all these rules that we've written for ourselves, and that is what makes a good state, rather than, does this state house its people? Does it educate its people? Does it look after its sick people? It's like, oh no, we're just going to forget about that, and we're just going to make sure that we follow, in this case, Bunrock na HÉireann.
Take of the Week this week is related to the Irish Independent, which has come out swinging against some of the costs that are associated with the United Ireland, at least according to a study that was published by the Institute of International and European Affairs.
That sounds serious.
Sounds very democratic.
It sounds very, very serious. Yeah. So basically, it says that there's a potential cost of $20 billion a year for the next 20 years, and that maybe we should be more cautious about trying to, you know, undo the historic injustice of partition. Sinn Féin, meanwhile, kind of, they've disputed the methodology of this, and they've said that actually the study assumes that there won't be any economic growth in the north, and there are all kinds of problems with it. Either way, the piece here has also featured a poll that was done by the Irish Independent, in which they asked, you know, would you be prepared to pay increased personal taxes to fund a United Ireland, which a new study has found would cost $20 billion a year for 20 years. No elaboration on that. No saying, like, would you have better social services or better infrastructure? It's just like, are you willing to pay for it?
I go further than that, even. I mean, there's, it shows the level of sleevinism in Ireland, where, yeah, you go to the US and Ta-Nehisi Coates, MacArthur grant recipient, I think. He was the kind of the public intellectual of the Obama era. Had a big falling out with Cornel West, actually.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
Yeah. He's like, you know, my point being, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates was that guy as far as public intellectuals go during the Obama era. So he's, you know, he's relatively of the establishment. He's probably left liberal. But I mean, one of his most influential essays is The Case for Reparations. Now, even with the US and all its problems, that is part of mainstream debate over there.
Yeah.
Reparations for those affected by the slave trade. Ireland, we're just like, I mean, John Fitzgerald was commenting, son of Gareth Fitzgerald, he was commenting about this report on RTE Radio, and he just said something along the lines of, well, if it's going to happen, we have to pay for it. It's like, really?
It's also part of the debate centres around, you know, well, why are we so closed off from the idea of rejoining the Commonwealth, right? Mm. The idea of, well, the idea of reunification is alien to a lot of people, particularly like media commentators and the political class, but like the idea of reparations, I'd say it's blasphemous.
Blasphemous. You know? More blasphemy on top of the blasphemy about the Gourds, Bunroch na Héireann. And unfortunately, we've run out of time for Leo Varadkar. Leo, we will, of course, have you on next week. Thanks so much for listening, guys.